We call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for this lovely May 8th and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 470 and ask Senator Moss Anderson to... I guess you can introduce it to us, Senator Moss Anderson. I think we'll have Senator Cruz along in a bit to...
Is he here?
To help you. No, not yet.
Okay. Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, I'm State Senator Lori Moss Anderson, and this is one of the most important bills. I have about three or four, but this is one of the most important bills that to me, anyway, because I have a family member who is using, who is addicted to prescription drugs. And in this House bill, I mean Senate Bill 470, addresses the abuse of prescription drugs. Unintentional prescription drug-related deaths in Oregon have increased 240% from 2000 to 2011. And these deaths could easily be prevented. And one way to prevent these unintentional overdoses is to raise awareness about the risk and keep physicians up to date on high-risk, high-dose prescriptions their patients may be taking. I feel we have a wonderful program here, the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, but there are some changes that we need to make to it. It's been operational for the past 19 months, and it's an incredible tool for providers as they prescribe medications that are subject to possible abuse. And then resulting in overdose deaths. The biggest obstacle, and very important, is using it to save lives, is that not enough doctors choose to use it. And this bill is trying to fix that. This will allow for improved use of the program. It will lead to better information for providers so they can better understand the prescribing trends, provide, I think, better care, and protect the safety of their patients. It's not to be voyeuristically monitor private medical information or catch addicts. That's not the intent, so that we can, you know, put them in jail. This bill is really about patient safety, first and foremost. And here's my cohort, Senator Cruz, who it's also extremely important bill to him. Prescription drug overdoses and deaths are an epidemic in this state, and if people in Oregon were dying from an infectious disease at the rate that they're dying from prescription overdoses, we would be doing everything we could to inform physicians on how they can stop the spread and save lives. And this is precisely what this bill, 470A, intends to do, and I will let my colleagues talk. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. I spent the last 2 days actually in Denver, Colorado on this very subject. Prescription drug abuse has become important enough nationwide that the National Governors Association has made it one of their top priorities. And, excuse me. And Oregon is one of seven states that are in the front end of coming up with appropriate ways of dealing with the issue. The co-chairs of that effort at the Governor's Association are the governors of Colorado and Alabama. We had a meeting of our group, and actually for some reason I'm the only legislator on the Oregon contingent, but we had the first meeting of that group about 6 months ago in Alabama, which I thought was interesting that we went to Alabama during the heat of the summer and then Colorado in the middle of winter. I would have reversed it, but it's not what they did. So, but it's been very informative to see what other states are doing about it. Now, 48 states now have a prescription drug monitoring program. They're configured in a lot of different ways. It took us, I think I worked on this for like 6 years before we finally adopted the program initially in 2009. And And it, of course, it took us a couple years after that to get the thing up and running and live. And what we have discovered since then is, as with anything brand new, there are modifications that need to be made in the program. And really, that is all this bill is attempting to do. For example, if we need to get a higher level of compliance, which we do, we thought it appropriate that that a physician be allowed to assign somebody in the office to do the actual data input. Now, what we have done in that is basically the liability still resides with the medical practitioner, but it, the liability also goes to whoever is assigned. So the liability is still attached, so there's every reason in the world to assume that the practitioner is going to make sure it's done right. We also discovered we had some issues with the identifiers we were using to make sure that Chair Greenlich, that your data is about you and not somebody else named Mitch Greenlich.
And Berwin Greenlich, which means they're not too much.
Okay. Point well taken. So we made some modifications in that. And Ms. Chair, I know you've been involved in this. The governor, this has been a priority for him. We had a big summit a few months ago on the issue. What I want to say is I appreciate when we first did it in 2009, it was a relatively controversial program. And a whole lot of people were not overly thrilled with it. But what was interesting this time, when this modification came to the Senate, the support was a lot greater than it had been first time around. I do know, Mr. Chair, that you have an amendment to the bill that you're not overly thrilled with the portion of the bill that would allow the Board of Pharmacy to put a non-scheduled drug into the system. And if the feeling of this committee is incredibly strong about that, I don't think that's something that we would oppose having removed. But I do want to also point out that the Board of Pharmacy, if it was a non-scheduled drug that they felt strongly enough about, they do have the ability to reschedule the drug. And my concern with that would be that then you put an additional onus on the patient and the doctor that would not be there with a non-scheduled drug.
They can also bring us specific things and ask us to put it into the statute.
They can do that, and we did have that conversation. But you know, that's and really we can go either way on that particular point. At this point in time, when we were comparing our program to the programs in the other states, I think we may have one of the best ones out there right now. I really truly believe that. The protections are there, and you know, it is about drug shopping, but it's, from my perspective, it's also been about good medicine, to allow a physician to know what is being prescribed to his patient by somebody else. And I go back to the case before all of this came about of my mother, who's got a wide variety of medical issues. And at one point in time, when she was in one of her frequent hospital stays, one of her doctors said, "This is crazy," and he pulled together all of her prescriptions and eliminated about half of them because they were working against each other. And so that's the other sort of thing that I think this program is going to allow us to do, is get safer and more efficient patient care, as well as dealing with the problem we have on opioid abuse in this state.
Senator Cruz, we have another amendment that I don't necessarily recommend, but we'll have in front of us in case the committee wants it, and I'd really like your comment on that. It's a section of the automatic automatic system for this. That amendment would delete that. Can you talk about how you feel about that, your perception of that?
If I could, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that is a really good piece of this bill. What it is, it's it basically, the system will be designed to where if the system itself, not an individual who's monitoring it, the system itself thinks that there is a problem in a prescribing pattern to an individual, it would send a notice to the providers of that individual that this is something you need to look at. There's no requirement on
all
anything.
All providers.
Yeah. All providers for that patient. Okay. There's no requirement for anybody to do anything, no penalty for not doing anything. It's just purely a notification that, oops, maybe this ought to be worth looking at. And you know, knowing how busy doctors are, you know, they're doing the data input. They may not necessarily have the time to take a look at the entire record, but if something red flagged and allowed them to look at it, I think for patient safety and patient protection, that would be a good marker to have in the process.
And at the heart of the bill, it's that other people in the doctor's office or in the pharmacy, other than the pharmacist or the physician, can be accessing the data with their own known identifiers.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I suspect it's happening right now, but we don't really know who's doing
that's
it.
That's right, exactly.
I would not say that we're making current practice legal. I would definitely not say that.
And Mr. Chair, regarding the Board of Pharmacy, we had a lot of discussion on this, and it's important for the committee to know that they wouldn't be adding just any drug. They are going to have protocols in place to identify legacy drugs that have a high potential for abuse. And Dr. Steiner Hayward mentioned two. But these are, high potential for abuse and misuse, but they are not controlled by the federal DEA. It's not, I still want the bill to pass if you make the decision not to do that, but because drugs do come up, I think this would be used very rarely, but if there are drugs that have a high potential for risk, that's why we thought that was a good idea.
We do have a letter from Rob Bivette, who is very much involved, who says,
yes.
And I had a conversation with him, he says, it's something I just thought up at the last minute. If it needs to go, I have no problem with it going. Make sure the bill goes forward.
Yes.
Ms. Chair, it's not the most important part of the bill. I made a flippant comment just a little while ago, but I do want to say that there are a lot of healthcare providers who are not accessing the system simply because they don't have the time.
Yes.
This would allow us to increase the universe of providers. And I would also say that we've got a commitment from OHA that they're going to be doing a whole lot more education at the various forums, like with dentists and people like that, so that the people will know actually how easy it is to participate in this. And we are hoping that this is going to increase our percent of participation by a significant number.
Well, I had problems with this early on.
Yes.
And I was concerned about even 2, 3, and 4, but now that we have it, we need to make it work in a way that serves the patients and serves the medical community. Do you want to comment a bit on the federal issue?
The federal issue, quite simply, is that the DEA, in their infinite wisdom, said that because all the providers in this network are there because they have a DEA number, that the DEA has access to the information. That case is currently in the U.S. District Court. The feds are arguing under the Supremacy Clause. We're arguing under states' rights. But I do want you to know that when I was in Colorado, I had a conversation with the folks from Missouri who also had a similar challenge by the DEA, and they won. Hmm. So we think at the end of the day, we will win this one as well.
Yeah. That comes out of the Florida situation where they were one of the early adopters, and in their system, A flag on the system automatically generates a police report, which is very interesting in a healthcare realm. I guess it's great for abusers, but not all people who are overutilizing these drugs are abusers known to themselves. So there's a healthcare component here. We chose not to do that in our program. And I think that's one of the chafing points with the DEA, because the states that do allow legal police access are using it to find drug shoppers in the resale market. We chose to go the other route of if you're buying drugs for the purpose of reselling them, which is a pretty much the case when you identify people who are buying lethal quantities of drugs, they're obviously not taking them, we cut them off.
Well, the
providers
is,
are notified and their supply is cut off without it going to a legal realm directly.
Yeah, the issue is more narrow. I mean, we built in the requirement that if law enforcement wants access to the system, they can get access,
right,
but they need to do it through a court order.
Right.
DEA said, well, we don't need to bother to go to court. We can just write an administrative subpoena. And the argument is then, does an administrative rule of the federal government trump a state statute? It's a very interesting.
Yeah.
It could go to the Supreme Court.
It could, Mr. Chair, it could go to the Supreme Court, but we think we're on incredibly solid ground, and we're not telling the DEA no. We're saying you have to go to the same probable cause standard any other law enforcement has to.
Seems so simple. Okay, other questions? Yes.
Thank you for bringing this forward. It is a really important issue. Two questions. One is about the unscheduled drugs. You mentioned that they could be at risk. They have high potential for risk, and my understanding is also that it could be contraindication with the other drugs that are scheduled. So if you can say anything more about that to justify that amendment. And the other is just, you know, how has it gone in the last year and a half? Have there been any concerns at all? There were concerns that were, you know, people worried about, potential concerns.
I think that the agency will be able to address that issue more thoroughly than I could. But just as I said, the Board of Pharmacy has the expertise to identify these legacy drugs that have the high potential for abuse and misuse. And that's where why we felt that it would be more expeditious for the safety of our patients to have that in. Yeah.
We'll have Mr. Burns coming out in a bit, and he can take all the abuse that you need. We need to treat the senators with dignity and kindness, but not the agency.
Mr. Burns on Monday night took the Oregon delegation on a kind of a wild goose chase through downtown Denver.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you
for bringing this. I really appreciate it. We have Burns, right, and
Becky Strauss.
And let's have Michael Miller with him.
That's Bill Cross.
Well, they are. I asked them to come up together. Mike, we always like you here to balance him. And we'll call Bill Cross for later for batting cleanup. Mr. Burns, can you give us some of the data, the background, what's been going on in the program? It would be very helpful for us.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, for the record, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Pharmacy Programs for the Oregon Health Authority. You passed this bill in 2000, this program in 2009. It went live in September of 2011, having spent 12 to 18 months building the system and putting in place a database that is 100% secure, that would guarantee that the records cannot leak, and finding a way to make sure that if there could possibly be a leak, we would know where it came from. The system is up, it's working, pharmacies are reporting. We have about 98% of all pharmacies are reporting data. We have over 11 million prescriptions in the system. We have about a million Oregonians in the system. I'm one of them. I will admit that. I take a sleep aid every once in a while, particularly when I travel cross country. And sleep aids are a drug that is scheduled, and therefore I am in the system. I've not asked to see what else I might be in for, but as far as I know, that's all I'm in for. We have about 4,000 prescribers in the system. And gut reaction, that's very low, and it is, and we recognize that, and we've applied for a federal grant in order to increase that. But rather than focus on just 4,000, what we really should focus on...
Would you clarify that? That's not 4,000 prescribers that have had a prescription entered into the system by a pharmacy, is it?
Yes. Yes.
So does that mean only 4,000?
No, I'm sorry.
That's physicians that are using it.
Correct.
That are inquiring into it. So we have more than 4,000 physicians.
Correct.
Or some number out of the pharmacies.
Yes, yes. Mr. Chair, you're right. Every time a physician writes a script for one of these drugs, that script ends up in the system, and we know who that prescriber is. There are 4,000 prescribers who are registered to use the system and who are actively looking at the system. It's not as high as we would like, and we're going out and trying to recruit more, but we have identified the 2,000 largest prescribers, and these 2,000 prescribers prescribe more than 60% of the product. Unfortunately, for reasons that we're not 100% clear on, only 55% of that 2,000, or about 1,100, are actually registered to use the system. One of the things we heard when we went and talked to them is, I don't have time. I have a short time to see a patient. The system is set up to all, I have to look it up when I have the patient in the room or in advance of seeing the patient. I don't have time to do it. I'd love to have my scheduling nurse do it. And this bill would allow the scheduling nurse to do it. They could open every morning, they could pull all the files, stick it in the doctor's records, and the doctor has it in front of him or her as they go out and prescribe. So we are getting there. We're not where we want to be, but we're getting there on that. Representative Kenny Gare, you asked a question that just went out of my mind.
Well, two. One was the non-scheduled drugs, you know, not only at risk of abuse, but I had also heard that they may have contraindications with the scheduled drugs, which would be a reason. Is that the case? And the other question was just, how has it been going over the last 2 years? You're giving some of that. Have there been any complaints about it?
Let me do the back half first, and I'll come back to it. Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, we're not aware of complaints. There have been an occasional person who, upon learning when they go into their pharmacist and they are notified by their pharmacist that the data is being collected, get up in arms and call us and complain. But it's few and far between. We have not heard from prescribers that they have concerns about it, mm-hmm. Other than it's difficult to use and they'd like to make it easier. Mm-hmm. So from that side. As to specific drugs, absolutely there are drugs that you do not want to prescribe with another drug. And the best example of that, fortunately in this case they are both scheduled drugs, is a benzodiazepine, which is a mental health drug, and an opiate. And you do not want to prescribe those two together, mm-hmm. Because they don't like each other in the body, and it's at risk. There are non-scheduled drugs that could be at risk, and we're not building a system to look at contraindications. Mm-hmm. We are building a system to look at potential abuse. So while there could be contraindications, that is normally caught by the pharmacist. When you present your script, the pharmacist says, "Wait a minute, I just filled this other drug for you. Did your doctor know you had that drug?" That should be something the doctor should be doing. This is not what the system is for. It's to say, why have you gone to 5 different doctors, mm-hmm. and you're in front of me seeing me for the same prescription? I've got the data in front of me. You picked up 5 prescriptions over the last 2 weeks. Why are you in front of me looking for another prescription? That's what the data is designed to do. Mm-hmm. It's designed to simulate a conversation between the prescriber and the patient about why the patient has what drugs they have in their pocket.
And if the doctor's nurse sit down, they'd have the same information.
Absolutely.
Yes. So I'd just like to follow up on that. So when you're talking about the pharmacist and the information the pharmacist looks at, so that's a different system than this from a standpoint of them knowing. So their records that they're keeping on their patients as far as what they're filling their prescriptions. Because when she asked the question about this potential interaction, I'm just trying to understand how many systems, again, are going on. And I understand that's not the base purpose for this. But so there's two separate systems there that the pharmacists have to use in order to...
Chair Greenlick, Representative Lively, there's a pharmacist sitting right next
okay.
to me who has practiced. I'm not a pharmacist, and I've only picked up drugs from the other side.
But this is an automated, note, so the pharmacist doesn't do anything about it, right? As the bill writes that you need to build an automated system to alert...
That's a different subject.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, but the interaction, too, is included in that phase.
No, the automated alert, Mr. Chairman, members, the automated alert system is designed to say suddenly a patient pops up with 5 different doctors over a week in the system. And the system looks at this, and whatever the threshold is, it could be 10, it could be 20, whatever the threshold is, the system would automatically generate a report and send a note to every one of those prescribers saying, "Hey, Tom has been in to see you. And other prescribers over the last week, you might want to double check the PDMP." That's all the alert would say. But as to how drugs interact with each other, I'll let the pharmacist.
Well, Tom, let me read that section. Yeah. It says, to a practitioner or pharmacist as part of an automated system,
integrated into the prescription monitoring program by the authority that is designed to notify that practitioner or pharmacist of a potential dangerous drug interaction. That's what the language says. It says, or, it goes on to say, or prescriptions made by multiple practitioners.
So it's really multiple practitioners. It's having too many drugs on the patient.
Yeah.
The drug interaction.
That's not what the language says.
You have shown, pointed that out to me in that
Mike, what do you think about this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I think the exact...
Who are you?
Oh, my name's Mike Millard. I'm sorry. I am currently, I'm the pharmacy representative on the advisory commission to the prescription drug monitoring program and serving as chair, and also had the pleasure to serve on the governor's task force for drug abuse. So to kind of get to this sort of fine point here, actually it's not that fine a point. The amendment, which I just recently, so I'm not an expert on what the amendment is, but I believe that that could also is meant to be driven on the screen when the profile is accessed and the report is run real time, that there would be some signal that says these conditions have been, so it's real time. I don't know that there's necessarily the intention of some sort of letter or some note to go forward. It's supposed to flag the person at the time of running the report, you know, when they get access.
It's not entered in a real-time basis. That is entered when it gets entered.
Well, the data comes in when the prescription's filled, and then Representative Lively, I can go to there are kind of two systems. The pharmacy system does detect drug interactions, so that's when a benzodiazepine in a controlled substance, when the pharmacist enters, you know, when there's a benzodiazepine present and you enter your prescription for the pain medication, a notice would come before you. That's called drug utilization review in the Board of Pharmacy regulations, which is required for the pharmacist to address that issue, either with the patient or the physician.
So, Mike, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You're not talking about, in this case, you're talking about the pharmacist and his individual.
Correct.
The data that goes in to the database here is a separate entry.
The data that is entered into the prescription drug monitoring program is the same. I mean, it comes from the automated system. That's the pharmacist system. So, sort of, see what I'm saying? So, the system I'm describing that gives you the flag is interrogated by the prescription drug monitoring system 1 week later to say, what prescriptions have you filled for controlled substances in the last week?
Yeah.
So, it's not different data. It's the same information.
The point is that the alert comes at some separate time, not at the time the prescription
Correct.
Is filled.
The of course, the automated download of the data to the prescription drug monitoring system has no programming. It just takes data. It doesn't note anything. And I think that's what the amendment is reflecting, is perhaps we should have the PDMP system take some of this data and look for parameters and alerts. The pharmacist system is already programmed to do that by law, so it has to do that because
but
that's
only
the regulation.
The prescriptions were filled in the same place.
That's what I was going
right.
to ask.
Yeah,
their
internal system.
Thank you, because that's where I was kind of going. The reason why the PDMP is very important to pharmacists is because, you know, if Payless is Payless and Fred Meyer is Fred Meyer, and that information is the only place where that information is shared is the PDMP. Hence the value.
And did you have something else to say?
This is a little bit of a side, but this is one of the reasons I think we talked about before. I'm interested when we get the electronic medical records to incorporate that system in there, because right now, if you go to two or three pharmacies because you're shopping price,
right.
None of those pharmacists know what you're taking in toto. So it's only if you get everything at one shop do you get the benefit of the safety piece, which I think is part of what we should be doing in healthcare reform.
Well,
but back to this program, I'm lost on a piece. The original intent when we were designing that bill, and it was based on what some other states were doing, that at a certain point, if you had 6, 10, 20 prescriptions for controlled substances, it triggered a notice. and we had talked about that. And I remember because Nevada had something incredible. Like you'd have 20 narcotic prescriptions in your name before it registered, and the reason was, they told us, that there were so many tens of thousands of people that had between 5 and 20 narcotic prescriptions, they couldn't handle it. So it was a big number.
I don't think that was ever put into the original.
Yeah, but that's a piece that we really, if we're going to have a triggering mechanism, that would be helpful, because that's where you get the drug shoppers, the people that are reselling. Yes, but you would know that if a doctor reviewing would know that information anyway without the trip. Yeah. Correct. The other piece, Tom, do you recall, I think we talked about this a year or so ago, do you have any numbers on what the penetration of usage is by practitioner group? Remember, at one time, dentists were very, very low in the system in number, percentage of licensed practitioners utilizing it. Do we have any tracking data on where the utilization is occurring by licensed?
Chair Greenlick, Coach, Vice Chair Thompson, by far the largest, both percentage and obviously numbers, are MDs. Okay. Dentists are, as a percentage, are very low.
Yeah.
And we have been working with the dental board to try and address that issue. And that's, interestingly enough, some of the very highest prescribers are dentists.
Yes.
Who are pulling wisdom teeth and handing out a prescription and pulling the next wisdom teeth and handing prescription out. And we are working with the dental board to target those to get them signed up for the program.
That's still a case.
Yes.
So
let's give Mr. Milano a chance.
Sure, go ahead.
If you have other testimony, we've got you to ask your question, then we'll get Representative Lively. So.
Just two items. Thank you very much, Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee. The only other thing I would add is just to let you know that I'm here representing the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition, so the pharmacy community is very, very supportive of this bill and really like to have you pass it. In whatever form, so we kind of are in the same position where, you know, we're supportive of the bill and the amendments, but, you know, remain focused on this idea of getting a better and more usable system for all, both physicians and pharmacists. And then just another comment on this, on the issue of interaction and that sort of thing. And I don't want to get into a deep technical dive kind of a deal, but this idea is fairly limited about non-controlled drugs that should be part of the PDMP or suggested. And I would just kind of sort of bring to your attention that the FDA has recently issued a what they call a RIMS, or a risk evaluation and mitigation strategy, making the company educate all providers on long-acting and extended-release opioids. And in part of that RIMS, which is a mandatory action, in this case it's basically an educational action, but it's part of the drugs certification. So you can go on the FDA RIP website and read the 64 pages of the RIM, but one of the places that they talk about is the drugs that they are concerned about. And, you know, I can provide this for the committee, but it's essentially tricyclic antidepressants, other CNS depressants, and those kinds of very focused things. So it's not we're worried about every other drug, because it's a good point that just general drug interaction is a clinical milieu kind of thing, not a prescription drug monitoring kind of thing. But the idea behind, there are a few drugs that increase the risk of the patient's inadvertent potentiation of the respiratory depression effects, which is where how you get to inadvertent death, which is the endpoint that the PDMP is most concerned about.
Is inadvertent two drugs, right?
Yeah, and so
they're on the database now.
Yeah, so what I just would like to offer the committee is that there's actually, the FDA has already offered a list of drugs that are not controlled that it feels are contributory to toxicity of the opioids, and so it isn't necessarily the Board of Pharmacy sort of shopping for potential drugs. There is some FDA guidance around candidates for drugs that And the idea would be when the practitioner is looking at the PDMP, they would be able to see these, because the idea is that's an argument for perhaps a different dosing schedule. In other words, oh, I usually give you 2 Vicodin, but I see you're on several potentiating agents, so perhaps 1 would be the correct dose for you, you know, because you have potentiating drugs. And I believe that sort of backs into the flag. In other words, another way to help a provider is, and one of the flags might be, is if some of these potentiating agents are present, that might be something would say, oh, by the way, there's other things on the in the patient's regimen that might, it, you know, might make you think about a slightly lower dose.
Is that alive?
So, so a part of this bill expands, quote, to practitioners who would have access based on, and I understand that. But so the goal is that they would use it each time they're dealing with the patient versus waiting for the flag? I mean, I'm trying to understand if they wait for the flag, I mean, there may be a borderline here, or is the goal to get them to look at it each time they're prescribing something new and use the data? That's the part I still don't understand.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Lively. That's up to the practitioner.
No.
There is no requirement that they use the system.
They use it.
We think once they are educated about it and learn about it, that they will find it's a valuable tool. They make the decision. If they see the patient is not abusing, they're not going to have to look it up. But if they, it's the brand new patient or a patient that they have seen 3 times for pain and they just can't quite really see the pain in the patient, that maybe they ought to look it up and find out why the patient is coming.
Great.
Okay, guys, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let me call who we have. Becky Strauss and Bill Cross. You can each reinforce each other. I know how close you are on this issue. No, I didn't.
Chair Greenlick.
Why don't we actually let Bill start? We'll be reinforcing what's been going on so far, and then I know, Becky, you have some concerns.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. And I was signed up mainly to introduce Michael Miller, who you've already met, who is our representative. And
well, thank you very much for your testimony.
We just... And thank you for this opportunity. In conclusion, we think this has been a very valuable healthcare tool, and we're very pleased with the first year and a half. This Simple 470 would make it more functional. So we urge your support. We have introduced an amendment because of some concerns that Chair Greenlick raised about the broad language that would allow the Board of Pharmacy to add other prescription drugs, and we wanted to make it very clear that those kinds of drugs would have to be demonstrated in terms of abuse, potential abuse in public health. So we do offer
that. Is that the Dash 11?
That's the Dash 11 amendments. Thank you for your time.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. The ACLU is in opposition to Senate Bill 470A. I've submitted written testimony that's very lengthy. I go through each of the pieces of the bill and our opinion about it and some suggestions, so I'm not going to spend all of that time to go through it. I hope you will have the opportunity to go through it. Since this program was put in place in 2009, we've had some significant concerns about the program because of the implications for the privacy of patients and practitioners who are cataloged in this database. I think that we've seen with the DEA lawsuit has been mentioned, some of those concerns have come true. We've aggregated a bunch of information, and we've made a commitment here in the state of Oregon not to use that information as a law enforcement tool, but in fact it is being used as a law enforcement tool by our federal government, and we have very strong concerns about that. The ACLU of Oregon filed a motion to intervene into the pending lawsuit between the state of Oregon and DEA. The
judge granted our motion to intervene. So we will be a third party at the table in that case to effectively, our argument is, regardless of how you come down on the preemption argument, the federal government should not be using administrative subpoenas. It's too low of a bar in terms of a display of cause to access these private records. So we hope to prevail on those arguments, but we're certainly not sure in any way of how successful those will be, and worried about the implications of the records ongoing. And so at that point now, we have Senate Bill 470 in front of you, and we really are concerned that this is not the time to be expanding the program really in any way. And there are many, many provisions to the bill that have not yet been discussed, and I hope you have an opportunity to look at each of those and think about those individually, about whether those should be part of the program. We've had a lot of testimony from the proponents about the system that we have now and making sure that it works and making sure that we have practitioners on board. That seems to only relate to the delegation of access to staff issue, and I think we should think about it in that way, and then also look at all the other things that are happening here and see if we want to go that route. In regard to the delegation of access by staff, I offer two suggestions if the committee is committed to moving forward with that concept. The first would be is that we've heard that 98% of pharmacists have signed on, so it seems like this is a problem that's become a barrier for practitioners rather than pharmacists, and so maybe there's a way to separate that out and say that practitioners may delegate in their office, but pharmacists don't need to. It's not been expressed, at least here today, as a barrier to them. Again, also in regard to the delegation to staff, from my quick research of a National Clearinghouse of Prescription Drug Monitoring laws, it looks like there are four other states that have this kind of broad access to staff that's being suggested in 470. Other states will make some sort of limitation, like one staff member in the office may have delegation, or only delegation can go to staff members in the office with a professional license. Our concern here is that as we delegate to more parties in the office, we're obviously opening up to higher risk of abuse to those parties, but also lower level of accountability, professional accountability for violation of the law or misuse of the database. So I would hope that you would consider any of those types of limitations. In regard to the Board of Pharmacy rulemaking, we are very concerned about that. I think that's probably our top priority of opposition in this bill. We think that I don't think that we intend to say that this is the lockbox and we should never have anything else databased as long as we have this system, but I think that conversation should be much more public, much more narrowed than simply rulemaking authority to an administrative process. I think that if there are additional drugs that should be tracked in the database, that should be a discussion that happens before you and the rest of the legislature. So we are in support of the A10 amendments that I have seen, and not I haven't seen the other amendment that's been mentioned today. I'll kind of rush through the rest. There are additional data points that are being collected about patients. I'm not sure that any of those are really necessary. We have the highest concern about collecting sex as a marker for a patient. I think that the idea would be that would help identify a patient in the limited scenario where there are two people with the same name or possibly a gender-neutral name living at the same address, because I believe address currently is a marker, where it would be unclear. And I think the problems it raises are maybe even more risky. I'm not sure who would be responsible for making that identification and whether that is really, on balance, the most necessary change. The other thing I wanted to mention, because it hasn't been discussed yet today, is that the bill would allow disclosure to the state medical examiner's office for the purpose of conducting medical legal investigation or autopsy, particularly in regard to conducting medical legal investigation. I admit that I don't really know what that is, but it sounds criminal investigatory. And I think that if the state medical examiner wants to be doing that, they should follow the same path in regard to the law enforcement provisions in the bill already. So we might add something about they can do so with a probable cause warrant to get further information about the deceased. And then finally, in regard to the alert system, again, admittedly, I'm a little bit even more confused after some of the discussion. I might suggest that provision is maybe not ready to move forward. I think that it's, I'm not completely clear about the benefit that it would have, and we have two categories of concern with creating this sort of automatic alert system, and I parse them out into practical concerns and philosophical concerns. Practically, we would worry about what would happen when an alert has gone out, an alert about a potentially dangerous interaction, and that alert is not correct, and someone is then has an unnecessary barrier to receiving the medication that they need. And then conversely, if an alert doesn't go out and someone who's either prescribing or dispensing is relying on no dangerous interaction having happened, what that means for care. I think that we are concerned now to the philosophical about the idea of using the PDMP more as a replacement for a medical record or even as a supplement to a medical record. In our view, that hasn't been what the program is set up to do, and I don't think functionally it's really able to do that. And so I worry about the over-reliance of the PDMP in that way. I think it may pose more problems than it would solve, and particularly when someone going into the system could find the same information. This would just be an extra alert, it seems like. And I apologize also if I'm not completely understanding the prior testimony about the linkage between the pharmacy. The pharmacists have an additional database, and I'll be sure to follow up to completely understand this. But I guess the flag that's raised for me is whether information from the PDMP is then going to a place where the login isn't required, and folks who might not necessarily have access to the PDMP or their access to that database wouldn't be tracked for auditing purposes, but that information is being shared. So apologies if I'm not understanding that, but just kind of raising some concerns. I'm going to leave you with the rest of my written testimony to kind of look through all the rest of the things that we have responses to, and thank you for your time to weigh in.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll ask you all to, that is a long document, but an interesting one. I'll ask you all to handle it. My intention to be hold this over until Friday and get back to it to consider at least the A-10 and the A-12 amendments, but maybe we'll wait beyond Friday. But it'd be very useful if you have a chance to check in on those. And
well, I have a question, and this you might be able to address this in your testimony, about the -12. I understand the 10 and 11. I don't really understand the 12. I have looked at it, so if someone
12,
can explain.
I think the 12 takes out the alert system.
Oh, that's what it does.
The 10 takes out the pharmacy,
the drug control,
and the 12 takes out the alert system. So, and I'd like you to each consider how you want to vote on the 10 and the 12. I think the 10 is really vital. I really feel strongly in getting out. The 12, I think we should think about that and have a debate and figure out how to vote. But I will close the public hearing and carry over the work session until Friday, and we'll see what we do with it on Friday. I'd like to open up the work session on House Bill 491. I'd like a motion to adopt 491.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 491 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
President Thompson moves Senate Bill 491 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Probably a no on 491. It's not so much that I'm opposed to adding a group of professionals to this, but just the whole consent form for parents. I think that needs to be revisited, and even though this is just adding a group, but still allowing them to see a patient and waiting a while before they actually consent with the parent. And I think we need to revisit this. So for that reason, I'll be a no on this.
Other discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would just like to say I not often agree with Representative Widener, but I agree with the concern. I'm going to vote yes because I think the bill is already in place, the underlying law in that, which I don't care much for, but it's there. And I think we should add these practitioners, but I am also in favor that revisiting the underlying law that deals with the 14-year-olds.
Well, I think Representative Kenemer and I have had this discussion about that. We ought to, before the February session, ask whether we want to find a way to put some sideboards onto that to make clear that. I think the bill's been around long enough now that it's time to ask that question and think it will improve where we're going to go. And whoever's carrying it on the floor and say, do you want to carry this or something?
Sure.
I'll be happy.
No, that's fine. I'm
done. Let's make that point that the peripheral discussion about the open-endedness of this has raised some concern in the committee, and we'll be looking at it before the February session. Okay. Would you call the roll?
Representative Peck?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
No.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Wiley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Greenwood?
Motion carries. Representative Thompson will carry the bill on the floor. Close the work session on Senate Bill 491. And let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 136A. And will you tell us about the bill and call some witnesses?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 136A authorizes the Oregon State Board of Nursing to allow certified registered nurse anesthetists to prescribe drugs. It authorizes the Board of Nursing to determine scope of allowance to assess fees as necessary and allows the Board of Nursing to determine procedure and grounds for emergency license suspension, establishes pharmacotherapeutics education requirements, and specifies certified registered nurse anesthetists may prescribe for no more than 10-day supply with no refills and prescribe only for established client or patient.
Thank you. Call, we have two witnesses.
Fawn Berry, Christy Cowgill.
Now everybody understands the bill perfectly. You don't have to cover that.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fawn Berry, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of Nurse Anesthetists, also known as ORANA, in support of Senate Bill 136A. ORANA seeks passage of Senate Bill 136A to ensure that prescriptive authority is an available health care tool for certified nurse anesthetists, also known as CRNAs, as regulated by the Oregon State Board of Nursing. Currently, CRNAs are the only group of advanced practice registered nurses who lack prescriptive authority. While ORANA is seeking the optional authority to prescribe drugs, prescriptive authority will not require a new skill for CRNAs. CRNAs receive an excellent academic and clinical foundation in pharmacology during their education. Oregon CRNAs currently are authorized to independently select, order, and administer medications to patients in Oregon within a care setting. Every day, CRNAs are selecting, ordering, and administering prescription medications to Oregonians throughout the state as those patients undergo various procedures. But because CRNAs lack prescriptive authority, they cannot offer their patients the opportunity to obtain medications from a pharmacist for use before or after a procedure. Easing anxiety or alleviating anesthesia-related nausea are two examples of reasons why CRNAs may want to prescribe medication to patients. Senate Bill 136A offers a way to fill that gap in a limited fashion while prudently expanding the continuity of care for patients. Amendments in the Senate remove the dispensing language from the bill. They address concerns by the Board of Nursing about education requirements and emergency suspensions. And the amended version adds in the language addressed by the committee administrator about CRNAs only being able to prescribe to patients for whom they have an established client record. And the amendments also limit CRNA prescriptive authority to a 10-day prescription. I also want to let the committee know that the language and rule for other advanced practice nurses state, prescribing is limited by the individual's scope of practice and knowledge base within that scope of practice. We fully expect that the same language would be in rule for CRNAs if Senate Bill 136 becomes law. We would ask for your support of this legislation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Christy Cowgill, and I'm a practicing CRNA and also represent ARANA as the Director of Government Relations. The ability to understand, utilize, monitor medications, and mitigate medication interactions within the entire spectrum of drug classes is one of the key roles of CRNAs as advanced practice nurses and as anesthesia providers. Before the CRNA completes his or her training residency for anesthesia, they have over 105 formal hours of pharmacology integrated into their basic education. CRNAs also have required continuing education in order to maintain their credentials. In the current practice environment nationwide, CRNAs work under the Nurse Practice Act provisions of select, order, and administer drugs. So here in Oregon, CRNAs, as Fawn alluded to, can currently accomplish making anesthesia plans for their patients under this provision, but the only thing that we cannot do is hand a patient a prescription that would be filled by the pharmacist. So by adding this prescriptive authority language and service, CRNAs would be able to provide fully comprehensive services to Oregonians. Currently, 28 other states allow CRNAs to have some form of prescriptive authority. So this wouldn't be something that Oregon would be leading the charge on. Washington State is one of those states to our north that offer prescriptive authority, and they were able to conduct a six-year study specifically looking at CRNA practices in prescribing over a six-year period. Washington allowed prescriptive authority for CRNAs in 2005. We do think in Oregon that CRNAs would trend very closely to what we've seen happen in Washington. And from that study, which is included in my testimony, not surprisingly, 97% of the CRNAs who were surveyed said that they prescribed anesthetics. But the other prescriptions that were prescribed were largely NSAIDs, which are drugs like ibuprofen or naproxen. And that's to give to the patients as an adjunct to the narcotics, which are usually prescribed by the surgeons. Narcotics did make up a lesser percentage of the prescriptions reported. And then other commonly prescribed drug categories were benzodiazepines, such as Xanax, which would be used as an anti-anxiety before surgery, sometimes given the night before surgery. Hypnotics like Ambien, which would be to help the patient who's having problems sleeping just before the day of surgery. And then non-narcotic analgesics such as Altram, as well given as an adjunct to possibly the narcotic prescriptions that would be provided by their surgeons. So these drugs are clearly within the scope of practice of anesthesia, and therefore CRNAs are already very familiar and comfortable with these drug classes and the way that these drugs work in the human body. Other findings that were uncovered during the study in Washington were that there were a small number of CRNA disciplinary actions in the state of Washington over that period of time, but no actions were as a root of abuses or misuses of the prescriptive authority in Washington. One can conclude that, as well as from feedback from our CRNAs that practice here, that while writing prescriptions for patients receiving anesthesia care does not occur with great frequency, there are several circumstances where having this authority would provide coordinated care and provide the needed medications to the patients both right before and after surgery or procedures that are performed here in Oregon. So for example, a patient arrives for their preoperative visit and they need an anti-anxiety or an anti-nausea drug that would be best suited if they started it before the surgery. Another example would be a patient has a post-surgery follow-up and presents with an anesthesia-related side effect, such as headaches from anesthesia or myalgias from some of the anesthesia drugs that were given during surgery. The CRNA could then provide a prescription for those ailments that they're most commonly situated to provide. So anesthesia providers, regardless of their academic credentials, are experts in this realm of patient care. And so we strongly urge you to support Senate Bill 136.
Did I hear correctly there's no opposition to this bill?
Chair Greenlick, that is correct. We worked out an agreement on the Senate side, which is reflected in the amendments that came over.
Are there any questions to this panel? Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill, Senate Bill 136A, and carry over the work session on Senate Bill 136A to Friday. Let's open a, we have a public hearing on 725?
That's correct.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 725A. You want to tell us what this bill does?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 725A specifies terms for contracts entered into between the Oregon Health Authority and coordinated care organizations, specifies conditions when a contract can be amended, and declares an emergency effective on its passage.
And I think I've told the committee before, we've worked out an agreement on the open meeting piece of the CCO bill. This is the vehicle that's been selected for carrying it. That's the Dastrey amendments. My intention today would be to amend the Dastrey amendments into 725 and then carry the work session over, because there's another potential amendment being considered, and we'll know by Friday, or failing that a little after, whether that amendment, it's on the basic bill, not on the Dastrey's. We'll see where that goes. So open up a public hearing on House Bill 725, and who do we have to visit with us?
Andy Easton, Susan Kirchhoff, Dana Steringer.
Okay, will you please join us and have at it. And please feel free to talk about either the basic bill or the Dastrey amendments when you're, if you feel so moved. Let's go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dana Steringer. I work at Family Care. We're a CCO in the Tri-County area, and we're here in support of Senate Bill 725. Senate Bill 725 creates a five-year evergreen contract for CCOs. This gives some clarity and certainty to CCOs as they make investments in long-term goals. As you know, CCOs are required to create innovative new programs, partnering with community agencies, with the counties, to create better and more innovative delivery system for healthcare. These partnerships are meant to be long-term relationships that the CCO has in the community, and being able to offer longevity to the CCOs through their contracts with OHA will help us achieve that. OHA doesn't understand this and is okay with this bill as well. For an example, one of the long-term investments CCOs are looking at making are electronic health records. These are systems that would, over time, be able to more effectively be able to manage care for members. And this is something that we would, you know, definitely need to know long-term that we would be able to use going forward. Currently, CCOs have annual contracts with OHA. These are typically updated at the beginning of the year and throughout the year with amendments. We're not looking to have a free ride, for instance, for 5 years. We're, you know, the contract renews when we meet our quality metrics with the state. So this is something that would still require sort of annual review with the state and moving forward that way every 12 months. And 725 is also going to help with administrative simplification, with reducing the amount of work that the OHA and the CCOs need to go through each year for the contract renewal process. And I'll end my comments there if you have any questions.
And I have also heard from OHA that they're okay with this. Yes?
We'll just question if you have any comments on the Dastrey.
Comments on the Dastrey?
For any of you as you give your testimony.
Okay. We're okay with the Dastrey amendment.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come here today to speak in support of the transparency amendment, Senate Bill 725. For the record, I'm Susan Kirchhoff, Chief Operating Officer of HealthShare of Oregon. HealthShare of Oregon is the largest CCO in Oregon, serving 165,000 members in Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas County. We do not have a position.
Is this the first time you two guys have agreed on anything?
We don't have a position position on the underlying bill.
That doesn't need to be
We're here today. Our comments are directed in support of the transparency amendment, which is a strong value of HealthShare. We believe the Community Advisory Council is the right place to engage the public and to receive comments that are value to the CCO. The HealthShare's Community Advisory Council was seated before the board, and it's made up of OHP members. Our chair is actually in the audience today, who's an OHP member, a consumer advocate, and is also a member of the governance board, so has direct relation to our governance. Our meetings are monthly. They're 4 hours in length. They're open to the public and the media. In fact, we send out a press release ahead of time announcing the meetings, and we reserve 30 minutes of each meeting for public comment. I'm relatively new to the organization. I had the opportunity to attend last Friday, and it's really very inspiring to see the work that they're doing. We had three families from the developmental disabilities community come and address the council directly, and that's the kind of input that the council receives, and then it's used to help direct the activities of the CCO. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to come and speak in support of the transparency amendment.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton, representing the Oregon Hospital Association, and we are here today in opposition of the underlying bill, Senate Bill 725. We are coming late to the table. We did not testify or make any knowns on the Senate side, and we recognize that, but the beauty of this process is that we have two sides of the aisle to work with, and this buys some time for us to review a bill very fully and thoroughly and have our position. We do have some concerns that I want to raise with the committee in hopes that we may have some amendments drafted to address some of these concerns. The first one is around the five-year. There is concern that the five-year length of a contract may be too long. That is outside of the biennium and the budgetary cycle. So we, you know, like to have some clarification as to why the five-year. We also find that Senate Bill 725 is not necessary. Currently, the Oregon Health Authority has the authority to do a five-year contract or a multiple-year contract. So we find that this is unnecessary in that regard. Our final point is that it also limits the opportunities for new CCOs to be considered. It puts in barriers around the lives covered and the global budgets that are set. So we would like to maybe have some conversation, further conversation around addressing that issue as well. I also am concerned with the language that is in the bill around the shall terminate the contract. It seems like it's very limiting to only the metrics. And maybe there might be another scenario for where OHA may want to cancel or terminate that contract. And so I'd like to work with the proponents of the bill as well as the committee to have some amendments drafted in that. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you all very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 725 and open up a work session on House Bill 725, and can I have a motion for the amendment, the -3 amendment, please?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt a -3 amendment dated 5613 to Senate Bill 725A.
Representative Thompson moves the -3 amendments dated, what's that date?
5613
to Senate Bill 725A. Is there any discussion? The amendments essentially recommend that next year there be two meetings of the Citizens Advisory Board that be open. They meet a minimum of quarterly, and in 2015 there be quarterly sessions of the CAC being open. It points out that neither the CAC nor the board are subject to public meeting laws. It makes that explicit because there was some question about it. And talks a little bit about posting notices on the websites. Is there any discussion of the -3 amendments? Is there any objection to the -3 amendments? -3 amendments are part of 725A. I must say I'm a little confused about the sudden opposition to that bill, since I haven't heard anything about it before this moment. So I didn't intend to act on this bill anyway, pending other things. So we'll set this bill over and see if I can get some more information on what's going on.
Mr. Chair.
Yep. Representative Conger.
To comment on that quickly, I think.
I always tend to my left first, as you know.
I'm afraid so.
We could work on
look
that.
Look how far out you are on the left there.
The far left.
I'm on the right-hand side if you're facing.
Stage left.
At least one of the concerns about the bill that was raised was also a concern to me and is the subject of my effort to offer what I would call really a technical amendment to clarify the language around the termination provision in the bill. And I have two objectives there that I think may help with at least some of the opposition. I didn't see it as being strong opposition, but maybe some concerns about the bill. But just to throw that out, in one respect, I think we want to make sure it's clear that's not the only reason these contracts can be terminated. And on the other hand, I think there's probably a need to give OHA some flexibility for a near miss or a narrow miss of the metrics and not force OHA to terminate a contract where the CCO is headed back on a good path. And anyway, so I'm going to try to work on that, and maybe that will help.
I appreciate it. I know you're talking to the proponents of the bill.
Yes.
It'd be useful if you often have a chance to talk to,
yes,
to the Hospital Association now. Senator Widener?
Actually, just kind of echo what Representative Conger was going to say. I like this bill much better than what we had before, and it looks like it does everything we need to, but the objections that the hospital brought up were actually legitimate questions that we have in there, and sometimes we have a little oversight when we're putting these together. So,
yep, we'll hear about it. Thank you very much. Close the work session on Senate Bill 725A as amended. Unless there's anything else to be brought before the committee. That's a lot of people out there. You must have something you're interested in. I will adjourn. We are adjourned.